That is one big pile of shit. This could be it. We may be in some multiverse where I don't even exist.
Don't knock rationalization. Where would we be without it?
Yes, yes. Yes, without the use.
To take them out, take them down. Do your stuff. Life finds a way.
Hello and welcome to episode 29 of The Complete Works, a deep dive into the career and films of actor Jeff Goldblum. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the wondrous world of Goldblum is my friend, co-host, and fellow Goldblum maniac,
Mike Tricia.
How you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing okay. I'm excited. It's a little got that like fall crispness in the air today. I had to put a second layer on to record, for our longtime listeners will know that we both are normally just completely drenched with sweat when we finish recording these episodes. So I'm shocked that it needed a second layer.
Yeah, at least in the summertime months, because we have to close our windows to prevent any sound from like coming into our bedrooms, basically.
Yeah.
We have to close our windows and, you know, turn off all fans and stuff. And by the time we finish recording a podcast, it gets sweltering in here. So, yeah, when I turned on the Skype call today and I saw you putting on a sweater, I was very confused.
Yeah, we'll see how long that lasts. Mike may get a little bit of a strip podcast because he has the video feed. I guess I'll let the audience know if I'm taking off my sweater. But
there you go. Every 10 minutes, one of us has to remove a layer of clothing and it becomes a strip podcast.
Like that scene in Ace Ventura in the rhino.
Is that the second one? Is that Ace Ventura?
Is that the second one? It might be.
I haven't seen either of the Ace Ventura movies since I was maybe 10 years old. And so it's been a while and I mix them both up. I remember Dan Marino was in the first one. And at some point, Jim Carrey says, "All righty then." And that's pretty much all I got. That's pretty much all I retained from Ace Ventura.
I think that's enough, because now when you think back on it, it's like super transphobic and that's not fun. So R.I.P. Ace Ventura, I guess.
Yeah, Ace Ventura 1 is canceled. Ace Ventura 2? Who remembers? Who's to say?
Yeah, we'll never know.
Actually, yeah, he does come out of like an elephant's butt or something in that movie, right? Isn't that like that's a thing? Yeah, there's you know, Jim Carrey mugging, doing his thing. We're not here to talk about Ace Ventura today, though, Mike. Even though we could easily do an Ace Ventura podcast on both of these movies that neither of us have seen in many, many years. Instead, we're talking about Jeff Goldblum, the co-star of Earth Girls Are Easy, starring Jim Carrey, who later became Ace Ventura.
It was close. It connected.
Yes. Today, we enter the decade of Jim Carrey, the 1990s. Actually, Jim Carrey, by the way, not in this movie. There's way too much Jim Carrey talk at the beginning of this podcast, right at the start. So we enter the 90s after a late 80s period for Goldblum as a leading man that saw one massive hit, The Fly, and several flops. Into the Night, Transylvania 65,000, Beyond Therapy, Vibes, Earth Girls Are Easy. So even though Goldblum was obviously well known at that point, it had become pretty clear that he may not have been the box office draw that the studios first thought he was. And the result is a few years of Goldblum's career that are a little all over the place, with a mix of TV movies, foreign films, and low-key studio pictures that all eventually lead to Jurassic Park in 1993, where it sort of becomes clear that this is what Goldblum does best. He's the guy you bring in to punch up the ensemble, not necessarily the guy who takes the lead, even though he's good at that too. Just audiences weren't clamoring for it, I guess.
Yeah. It's such a weird period of his career to be, you know, going through all of the movies for, where it's like, man, number one movie, boom, smash hit, The Fly. This is it. This is a king making movie. And then it just like can't capitalize on it for 10 years. Right. Not 10 years. Yeah. 7 years.
Got a few cult classics out of it, but otherwise not much going for Goldblum over that period of time. It's going to be a couple months before we reach Jurassic Park in this podcast. But today we're going to talk about Mike's favorite subject, TV movies. Another one. That Jeff Goldblum was in, although this one wasn't produced by one of the main networks or even basic cable. Today, we're talking about a movie that originally aired on HBO in 1990. So, of course, now HBO has a reputation. They are like the Criterion Channel of cable for the past two decades. You know, the Criterion Collection, you know, they are known for quality shows. It's the channel that's brand is synonymous with quality programming. I mean, back in the early 90s, it was really just starting to make a name for itself. So, Mike, I mean, you subscribe to HBO. For me, HBO has always been the channel where it's like, OK, if there's a new show on HBO, I'm probably going to be interested in it at least a little bit, you know, and for a long time, I would watch everything that HBO put out. Since then, I graduated high school and don't have time to do anything anymore. For a while, I was doing it. So how about you? What's your relationship to HBO?
I feel like, you know, their old motto, is it even still their motto that it's not TV, it's HBO?
I don't think it's their motto anymore, but that was like the thing that kind of put them, that was their iconic slogan from the early 90s. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they were, you know, they were just play movies and that was like, you know, as a movie family, originally, they still do obviously, but like, I feel like Now in the last 15 years, since, you know, The Wire, Game of Thrones, all that stuff, they've become like a premium series creator, like a regular TV network, which is strange. But yeah, that's kind of the same thing for me, too, where it was, you know, growing up, it was always just whatever random movie we could find and watch on HBO. That's how I watched, you know, Enemy of the State and Tremors and all these like random action movies all the time because they would come on and we would stop and watch them. But yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, like everyone else, I'm sure, since Game of Thrones at least started. I can't remember what was the one right before Game of Thrones. That was the big one.
I mean, there was True Blood was on HBO. Boardwalk Empire was another big one on HBO there, too. That was one of my favorite shows. I was huge into that. I mean, The Wire, The Sopranos, Deadwood, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm, not a drama show, but still. And, you know, big on the comedy shows, too. I mean, Eastbound and Down, Bored to Death, Veep, Silicon Valley. I mean, a lot of huge shows came out of the HBO camp. The Night Of. Remember that show? The miniseries?
I do remember The Night Of. Yeah, that's right.
We were really into that back in the day. Watchmen just last year. We were both big fans of that. I just started watching Lovecraft Country, which first episode. Very, very good. Very into it. HBO, good network. We're both fans.
Turns out, you're welcome, audience, for us for telling you that HBO is good.
Exactly. But of course, before they were that in the early 90s and throughout the 80s, HBO was pretty much just a channel that showed movies. And it was popular because it was uncensored, uncut movies. But that was pretty much all they did. And by the time the 90s came around, they started to really dip their toe into producing their own content. And that resulted in kind of the pre-peak TV HBO shows, the pre-golden age of television shows, stuff like Mr. Show with Bob and David, The Larry Sanders Show. Tales from the Crypt was an HBO show from the mid 90s. And they had already been doing TV movies for the better part of the 80s. Today, we're talking about one of them. It's 1990s crime comedy film Framed.
Jeff Goldblum was a painter.
Shouldn't I take my clothes off now?
His love, the works of the masters.
It's real.
His job, forgery. Until he was framed.
She's gone. 5 million francs are gone.
I thought you...
You thought I what?
Set me up.
I have just spent 2 years fleeing for my life because you didn't have the common courtesy to keep quiet.
Now, this time...
All we have to do is paint a copy, switch one for the other, and it's ours.
If he can believe the woman he loves...
Okay, before you say anything, just let me say that I know what I'm doing. I know that it looks like I don't know what I'm doing, I'm just being whipped around, but actually, I do know what I'm doing.
That's good, because actually, it does look like you don't know what you're doing.
Yep, that's right.
Steer clear of the mob.
Uh-huh.
And outsmart the FBI.
Agent Ott's a joke. FBI.
Agent Joke
is Danish.
He just might make the switch.
Is it real?
No, it's a painting.
Jeff Goldblum of The Fly and The Big Chill in Frame.
priced at $89.99 per single units, or save $60 off the suggested retail price by ordering twin packs, with each cassette priced at just $59.99.
So, of course, Jeff Goldblum has a history of TV movies, and he's one of the few actors in the 80s that really did both TV and film without it impacting his career all that much. The difference is, this wasn't TV. This was HBO.
There it is.
Yeah. So they had already started to build their premium reputation, and so their TV movies were often filled with pretty good names like Danny Glover, Powers Booth, Pierce Brosnan, Helen Mirren, and more. You wouldn't see like the all-time biggest superstars of the day on there, but you were definitely able to attract talent if you were an HBO movie. And Framed is a fun one to talk about, I think, because so often these TV movies are based on true stories or are about big dramatic historical events or an adaptation of something popular. Like we've covered a couple of those already with stuff like Sleepy Hollow, Ernie Kovacs Between the Laughter, and Life Story. This one's just an original idea about a painter doing art forgery, trying to steal a painting. That's worth 82 minutes of people's time, right,
Maya? Yeah. Yeah, why not, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So Jeff Goldblum stars in Framed as William, sometimes called Willie, and he is the art forger who's working with his ex, Kate, played by Kristin Scott Thomas. And this was pretty early on in her career. Of course, she'd go on to be in movies like Four Weddings and a Funeral, The English Patient, and Gosford Park. Goldblum's got a best friend who helps him out named Pete, played by Todd Graff, who's probably best known as the conspiracy theorist guy in James Cameron's The Abyss. Have you seen The Abyss, Mike?
I have, but not recently enough to recognize that guy.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I've seen The Abyss once, maybe like 7 years ago, and I really liked it, but I'm very much due for a rewatch of that movie. And in our very first Four Pete's Goldblum reunion, Kate is engaged to be married to the guy they're stealing from, a crime boss named Elliot Shane, played by Michael Lerner from St. Ives, Threshold, and Vibes, Mike.
Man, of all the people to get to a four-peat first, it's Michael fucking Lerner.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, it might be the one that makes the most sense because he's a character actor. He just kind of pops up in a lot of things. So, yeah, I guess it kind of makes sense that he would just be a supporting role in a bunch of Goldblum movies. But there you have it. Michael Lerner, the first four-peat Goldblum reunion. A couple of other notable people pop up in this thing, too. Agent Joke is played by Abdul Salam El-Razak, who is known for playing Gibbons in Terminator 2. Mr. Chu, the owner of the bar that Goldblum works at, is played by James Hong, legendary Chinese character actor who appeared in movies like Blade Runner, Big Trouble in Little China, and Wayne's World 2. He's also the maitre d' in the classic Seinfeld episode, The Chinese Restaurant. So there's that, too. Yeah. And finally, the one that made me kind of sit up in my chair. I don't know if you caught this one, Mike. I'm sure you did. Carol Struycken, a.k.a. the Giant from Twin Peaks.
yes.
plays Jinx, one of Elliot Shane's henchmen. So I was very excited to see him. He was also Lurch in the Addams Family movies, Addams Family and Addams Family Values back in the early 90s. So Framed was written by Gary Rosen, who also worked on the Damon Wayans comedy Major Pain and was a producer slash writer on the TV series The Librarians in recent years. And it was the directorial debut of Dean Parasot, who would go on to direct Galaxy Quest and just recently directed a movie that we were both big fans of, just reviewed on Mike and Mike Go to the Movies, Bill and Ted Face the Music.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. It's such a weird like connection to go back and see like his first movie and then we just reviewed his most recent movie. Look at that.
Yeah, so kind of cool there. Framed aired on HBO on June 24th, 1990. However, if you were watching something on one of the four networks instead, that's right, I said four because now Fox has entered the picture. They are a network now. You could have been seeing America's Funniest Home Videos followed by Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan on ABC. over on CBS, it was 60 Minutes, followed by a repeat of Murder, She Wrote, and then a repeat of their TV movie Bridge to Silence, starring Lee Remick and Marlee Matlin. On Fox, you had a new America's Most Wanted, followed by a repeat of The Simpsons, and then Married with Children and In Living Color. And finally, on NBC, you could have been watching a Honeymooners rerun, followed by a repeat of one of their TV movies, 1989's She Knows Too Much.
So just there you nobody go. Had any new TV shows. That's crazy.
I mean, it was June 24th. So it was, you know, the summer had kind of started already. The fall and spring had kind of ended. Back then, Mike, if you were a summer TV show, you were a burn off. You weren't, if it wasn't from fall to spring, it was nothing. There was no, It was nothing. Now TV can air pretty much whenever, and it confuses the Emmys a lot, because then a show can air in, like, you know, July of one year and be nominated for Emmys in September of the next year, and it creates a big gap. But back then, I mean, the reason the shows existed the way they did is because from fall to spring, that was the Emmys eligibility period. So there you go.
Yeah, it's pretty funny to think about how it only took, you know, 20 years, not even 20 years, 10 years, I feel like, maybe by 2000, the complete network landscape was very different.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really became different in 2000 once HBO got really big. Since that's we're talking true. About it, I mean, that's around the time Sopranos premiered, and, you know, everybody got, you know, hooked on the serialization aspect of it, and then it just kind of steamrolled from there. But all right, the IMDb plot synopsis for Framed reads, a painter is accused of art forging. He thinks his girlfriend betrayed him, so it's time for revenge. So, Mike, we both watched this movie on YouTube, which luckily it got uploaded there like 3 weeks ago, which is very convenient for us. If there's somebody listening to this podcast who is somehow doing that, we need a copy of Twisted Obsession next week. Just throwing that out there. It's a really hard movie to find. So we're hoping to be able to watch that. But yeah, Framed is on YouTube right now, so anybody can go and check it out. What did you think of the movie Framed, and what were you expecting going in, Mike?
I mean, going in, I didn't really know what to expect. It seemed kind of like more of a drama, at least from that, like, you know, one line description. And, you know, the synopsis, for, like you said, is barely any footprint for this movie at all. So yeah. I didn't really know anything going in, although I guess I should have known. You did mention that it was the director of Bill and Ted Face the Music, although I forgot which movie who it was. Like, I knew it was some recent guy, but when I sat down to watch it, I forgot exactly who it was. So I didn't really know what to expect. So I was unsure of the tone a little bit. And when it first starts, like, it's kind of feels like a crime movie, right? The opening sequence in Paris when he's getting busted by Interpol and there's a big foot chase and all this stuff. And I was like, I don't know what's going on. And then it kind of, there's like some jokes here and there in the beginning, and I wasn't quite positive what's going on, but then it kind of settles in and it finds that kind of like crime comedy rhythm a little bit more. And I kind of got on more on its page and kind of took it for what it was worth and remembered, like, oh, this is a 1990 HBO TV movie. So, like, what am I comparing this to? Right. Like, who am I to say? And so I ended up, I think, overall had like a pretty fine time with it. Like, I didn't dislike it, but I wasn't super engaged with it overall. But like, it's fine enough. It's Goldblum being tall and handsome. It's everyone looking fun, like, you know, looking really nice and having fun. And there's like this kind of weird, it might just be because the giant is in it. But from Twin Peaks, but there's this weird, like, David Lynch under, like, crime underworld feel to it. Like, you know, like Goldblum, after he gets out of prison, like, he's like the bartender at like the saddest bar ever named, like, Achu's Chinese restaurant, where people are, which is hilarious. And the guys are like just smashing fortune cookies and not reading the fortune. And somebody's like trying to scrape his tattoo off with a knife. And it's just like the saddest looking. It's like the salty spittoon or whatever. No, what was the in SpongeBob? Yeah.
I don't know. You're thinking of the Roadhouse in Twin Peaks, right? That's what you're kind of imagining, right? Okay. Yeah. I was actually thinking, like, you could just insert the that, like, lounge singer from True Detective season 2 in there, and
right, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is.
The saddest bar entertainment of all time.
So overall, the tone is like a little all over the place, and it's fine for the most part. But ultimately, it's like you said, it's an hour and 20 minutes. It's 80 minutes long. It's not a chore to sit through. You know, this could have been in a today world, this would be, you know, 2 hours and 20 minutes, and I would hate every second of it.
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm sort of with you, but maybe leaning a little bit more positive on the movie. I thought it was fun. You know, it's slight. It's a very slight movie. But, you know, I think it gets by because, yeah, you're right. It does kind of start off as, like, I don't think it never necessarily takes itself so seriously at the beginning, but it is like sort of like, oh, what is this? Goldblum's in a chase and things like that. And then as it goes on, you know, it's very clearly like sort of a comedy also. And there's some solid jokes in there. I think the last 15 minutes or so are genuinely kind of like surprising and fun. You know, I think there's like a lot of twists and turns they take, and I like the way it doesn't reveal information to you until you absolutely need it at the very end. So I like that stuff, and, you know, it does a good job of keeping you guessing about whether you can trust Kate, Kristen Scott Thomas, and who the real Saki Budek is, which is a name that I had to look up like 10 times before I started writing it down. And I'm still not entirely sure if I got it right. You know, because there's two characters in the movie that could potentially be Saki Budek, and Saki Budek, we're told, is the bad guy, but he might also be the good guy. So there's a lot of like confusion about what's going on. And the movie plays off that really well. And Goldblum's just like, I have no idea what's happening at any given time in this movie. And I enjoyed that aspect of it, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of got that like weird, like madcap feel about that specifically, about just like everyone is a con artist in this movie and nobody really knows who to trust, or at least Goldblum, like the protagonist, has no idea who to trust. And like, he can't pull off a con really, even though he's an art forger. So like, it's like this weird, like fish out of water type situation.
Yeah, definitely. So, I'm going to ask you, what did you think of Jeff Goldblum in the movie, Mike? Before I do that, I think before we talk about Goldblum's performance, we got to talk about his hair, in the luxurious locks of Jeff Goldblum in this movie, Mike, because the first time you see Goldblum, he is sitting up from a bed after just having sex. He's shirtless. His hair falls down to his shoulders. Yeah. It's Goldblum Fabio. He's Goldblumio in this movie. He's amazing. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. There's I'm going to cheat and answer before you ask, well, you know, what movie do I think this connects to, or whatever the hell. Now, you've been asking me that question for 5 years now, and I still don't know the exact phrasing of it off the top of my head. However, I'm going to cheat and pick one from our previous Complete Works episode, because this movie connects directly, and it's the hair, directly to Zandali.
Oh, yeah, 100%. It's not just the hair, it's the art stuff, too, because Nicolas Cage is a painter in that movie. Yeah.
So, who also has long shoulder-length, mullet, wavy, black hair.
Yep. And was also a very early 90s thriller. That was like 91, I think. So this was like around the same time as Zandali. So like conceivably on HBO in the early 90s, like during a rerun during the day or something, you could have watched back to back Framed and Zandali.
Wow, and what a double feature.
Man, what a day that would have been for you if you were the person who watched those things. If you have no idea what Zandali is, if you're just a Goldblum fan that jumped onto this podcast, go watch a supercut of Cage freaking out in it. It's great. I mean, there's really only like one big Cage freak out, but it's like, you know, he's covering himself in paint and he's naked and he's shouting in a warehouse. It's prime Cage stuff right there. Mm-hmm. Movie itself, terrible. But if you've ever wanted to see an erotic thriller with Nicolas Cage and Judge Reinhold, then that is a movie for you. So Jeff Goldblum, what did you think of him in the movie aside from his connection to Zandali, Mike?
Oh, right. I think he's pretty fun. He's, you know, he's doing his Goldblum thing, although it feels a little weird doing that kind of the stutters and the, you know, not really sure where the sentence is going to end kind of thing. He doesn't do that very much in this movie, but it does happen sometimes, which feels a little weird considering he's supposed to be like, oh, I don't know if he's supposed to be a suave art forgery criminal guy, but like he kind of is, and you know, like he is an art forger that like sells fake paintings and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's like a weird mixed with the tone stuff, which I kind of talked about already. But overall, I think his performance is fine. Like, it's good. It's Goldblum. He's doing his Goldblum thing, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, it does actually, I think that does work in the movie the way you're saying it, because in the beginning, you know, he does feel like that like suave art forgery guy. And then he doesn't right after that. Right. But in the beginning, he gets arrested and then spends 2 years in jail, and it picks up in Los Angeles 2 years later. So I feel like I get the sense that like he sort of, and I think the movie doesn't go into it enough, because it like almost immediately he finds Kristen Scott Thomas again. But again, this movie's only 82 minutes. It moves. But like, I think those first scenes with Goldblum and he's hanging out with Pete and he's bartending and stuff, he is a little like broken from his earlier days, right? He's supposed to be like somebody who has just spent some time in jail and, you know, was betrayed by the woman he thought he loved and all that kind of stuff. So when he sees her again, he kind of slowly over the course of the movie kind of gets back into the groove of being the suave criminal guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He gets his mojo back. You're right.
Exactly. Like Austin Powers. But yeah, I think he's good. I think he and Kristen Scott Thomas play off each other really well. And he seems like he's having fun. He seems like he's just having a good time being part of a heist. And isn't that all any of us could want in anything? It's just to be a part of a heist and have fun doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're 100% correct. That's all anybody wants.
So other than Zondali, Mike, how does this fit into the roles that we've seen Goldblum play so far, do you think?
You know, this is pretty hard. I feel like I couldn't really think of any. I feel like maybe Rehearsal for Murder, just because it's a TV movie that's kind of also like a crisscross, twisty-turny.
Sure.
Reveals in the third act kind of thing. I mean, we'll hearken back to the evergreen. I almost said Rehearsal for Murder again. The evergreen Next Stop Greenwich Village, because why not? He's an actor in that movie, and also he acts in this one.
Yes, this is true. In fact, Goldblum is in both movies, so it counts.
There you go.
But Rehearsal for Murder was the one that I had kind of pinpointed. Also, it's also a TV movie about the same like level of production quality too between the two movies too, and it's just. You know, fun, breezy crime movie with some good dialogue in there. I also did note that this movie has a sudden reveal of karate with the Giants and from Twin Peaks, like doing a roundhouse kick or something, or an around the back kick, which is just like a 10 speed and brown shoe when it's revealed through the pilot that Goldblum knows karate without explanation. It's the best. So, that's two sudden karate reveals that we've gotten in Goldblum projects so far. So now we're making that a counter that we has to. I mean, who knows? That could happen again. We'll see. That's the beauty of the sudden karate reveal is you don't see it coming. It's very sudden.
Yeah, we got four. Nope, three. We got four Michael Lerners, three deaths, and two sudden karate reveals,
and a partridge in a pear tree. All right,
that's right.
So let's run down the movie scene by scene, Mike. It starts. With the HBO Pictures logo. I feel like I wanted to like,
oh yeah, I did. Right. I did note that down actually.
Yeah. I was like, man, this kind of took me back a little bit. I was like, this feels really retro. I mean, it is really retro. It's the 1990 HBO Pictures logo. I don't think HBO produces anything anymore without just like the staticky background and the HBO logo that goes, oh, right. Like that. It's been like that since like 2000. So to see like the original HBO Pictures logo, it's all like colorful. It goes like, burr, 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 burr.
It's like the Rugrats intro.
Yes, 100%. It's the Rugrats intro of HBO logos. I wanted to quickly mention that the HBO Pictures logo is the 1990 version. So that was fun. And then, from there, we kind of talked about the opening scene a little bit. But, we're in Paris. It's raining. Goldblum and Kate are having sex. And then she leaves and they're kind of like talking about like the heist they're about to pull off or maybe have just pulled off or something like that. But you don't really know exactly what they're talking about because you're just entering the scene. And I like that. They don't like kind of reveal everything to you in a way where it's like, you know, everything's going on. And she leaves and like puts a pillow under her shirt and pretends to be pregnant and things like that. There's a whole kind of conspiracy going on around just in the room that we're not privy to. And then Interpol arrives and chases Goldblum out of the room. So he gets arrested for art forgery. So what did you think of this whole prologue, Mike? What did you think of it kind of setting you into the scene for the movie?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I should have known right away because that it was going to be more on the goofy side because it starts with like that neighbor guy like watching like an old scary movie on the TV. And it's like, you know, big, stormy, dark and stormy night. And he looks out the window and it looks like it's raining. But really, then the camera goes up to the bathroom above in the apartment above him, which is overflowing the bath because Goldblum and Kate are having sex instead of turning the water off in the tub. So I guess I should have known in retrospect what this kind of movie was going to be. But overall, like, I mean, that's that scene is pretty fun. And it's I think it's a fun way, like you said, to kind of just like throw us in the middle of whatever's going on where they're like, OK, you're going to Geneva. I forgot, or wherever she's going. And like, you know, we're kind of international criminals or some kind. And we're not really sure. Then there's this Bigfoot chase and he gets busted. And then, it turns out he's an art forger, which is a pretty unique criminal background to focus on, I think, in a movie. You don't really see a whole lot of that.
Yeah, I also liked when he was being arrested, the cop was like, do you know how serious art forgery is as a crime? And I was like, I could name like 15 more serious crimes than art forgery in 5 seconds. this is a little much. I mean, I get it. You know, he's arrested and stuff, but it's still just like, Jesus, man, like, calm down.
Interpol's got nothing else to do, you know?
So anyway, the movie picks up 2 years later, and now Goldblum is in Los Angeles. He's working as a bartender, and there's a moment where it looks like he got a haircut, and I was very upset about it. Like, it shows him in the bar, and his hair is, like, you know, shorter. I was like, oh no, he cut his hair over the 2 years, and then it turns out, no, it's a ponytail. He keeps the luxurious locks the entire movie. So that was great to see. Very excited about that. Hopefully, like, he grew that out, not just for this movie, but for the next, like, several movies before Jurassic Park. That's the hope. But we'll see what happens. So Goldblum's hanging out with his buddy Pete. Pete is also kind of an artist, also maybe like a scientist guy. It's never really like clearly defined what Pete is. But he shows up with like these two models of brains. And there's a recurring joke in the movie about how like, oh, well, men have like a smaller, you know, cerebral cortex or whatever. And that's why like men aren't as in touch with their feelings. So when a woman asks them what they're feeling, they don't know. They're always confused. And that becomes like a recurring joke in the movie, which actually pays off pretty well at the end of the movie too. And just the climactic scene. So I did like it by the end, but like for a while, it's just like, I don't know what the point of this is. I guess it's just to make Pete be like, huh, men are dumb. And that's basically it.
It felt a lot like, haha, 90s gender jokes. And I was like, I don't know how I feel about this, I guess a whole lot. Not that it's like problematic per se, but it just feels like it's not that funny.
It's one step away from him being like, you know, men never want to stop and ask for directions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Although I think overall, like, Pete is a very fun and silly character, and is like also like kind of like the satire of like the performance artist kind of archetype guy, which I kind of like how this movie kind of like, you know, satirizes the art world and stuff, like takes like you said, the guy we like, do you know how serious art forgery is? Like kind of making fun of how self-serious that whole community is.
Right. And actually, speaking of, so Goldblum sees Kate and he follows her to an art museum, which is filled with classic cars and also insane looking robots that look like they're about to go on a rampage. There's like one moment where he's like, you know, following her through the museum, and he's like trying to like rush through, and there's like this one weird robot in the corner that's just like turning and like moving around in like all these different directions. It's a very distracting piece of set design, I guess is what I'm saying.
yeah, but it's a fun, and like, you know, the attendant at the art museum won't let him in until he like begs her, basically, and then she lets him in for free, and kind of making fun of like you said, that whole scene. And I do love that moment too. Like, he follows her in, and it's just like car horns blaring, and like, you know, it's the studio's made to look like a traffic jam, and Goldblum like walks in and like rolls his eyes. It's like, oh yeah, we all get it.
Yes, it's pretty solid stuff. So they catch up, they kind of have a fight. Goldblum's like, I thought you abandoned me, and she's like, I didn't abandon you. You talked in the joint, and you know, you sent people after me,
right?
And things like that. And so there was a misunderstanding, and they sort of make up a little bit. They get in a cab together, and then they start making out like almost immediately in the backseat of the cab. And that's you know, pretty funny. But like while that's happening, there's a guy standing there. And he watches them drive off, and it's like, ooh, who is this guy? We'll see what happens. And so they meet for dinner, and she's late. Goldblum is smashing his watch against the table because he's like, what time is it? And it like disrupts the band. Like, it's so loud, they stop playing. She finally shows up, and they dance, and they make out some more and all that stuff. So, I mean, all this stuff kind of leading up to the big plot of the movie. Like, what'd you think of all this, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, that scene too felt like very weird. Like, I feel like Lynchian became like a cliche term, and I don't know how else to describe, just like strange, I guess is the more appropriate word. But when he's smashing the watch, and then the band stops, and like the whole bar turns and looks at him, and then just all goes back to normal. Then right after that, like, they finish dancing and they go to get their coat, and it's like, there's just a couple sitting on the coat, and they're like, if you knew us, we would, you know, we don't sit on coats. And it's like, who the fuck are you people?
Yes. It was actually exactly, it was worded. And this is my favorite line in the movie because it came out of nowhere. If you knew us, you'd know we do not sit on coats. Like, they were so indignant about it.
How dare you? And then the guy walks up to Kate, and he's like, you know, some people go crazy thinking they're being followed, but I want you to know that you are being followed. It's like, what the fuck is happening? What is this movie? I don't understand.
Yes. Yeah. So it's the same guy who watched them drive away in the cab a few minutes ago. And so he tells her that, and she like bolts. She runs away. And then, you know, she ditches Goldblum. Goldblum has no idea where she is. And so Goldblum leaves the place, sees that Pete is right outside with his car and being like, yeah. Oh, so she ditched you, huh? Like, and so Goldblum and Pete get in the car. They see that she got is getting into a cab, and they follow her cab to a mansion. And then they try to get into the mansion themselves, but they can't get past the guard at the gate. Which is a pretty funny scene with like Pete arguing with the guard and stuff like that. So that was pretty good. And then, you know, they ultimately just like back up and get out of there. But then they sneak in the next day, discover that Kate is pretending to be a woman named Anna and is getting married to a crime boss, Elliot Shane, played by a four Pete Goldblum reunioner, Michael Lerner. That's his official title on this podcast now. But yeah, so that whole sequence where they're, you know, kind of mingling in the party. There's one guy who's like dripping wet for some reason. Do you remember that?
That sounds familiar, but actually I don't remember that.
It's only like one like quick shot of the movie, but it's like while it's doing establishing shots of the party and like people at the party, there's like one shot where you cut to a guy and he's just like dripping. And I couldn't tell if it was sweat or somebody had just like dumped a bucket of water on him or something. But it was very weird because they never cut back to that guy ever again. He's not like in the rest of the movie. He's just dripping wet.
Good for him, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. You know, he stayed cool. It seemed like a hot summer day.
It did.
So they're at the party, and Goldblum kind of has a confrontation with her, like while she's standing next to Elliot, and he pretends to be like her dance instructor's husband or something like that. She and Goldblum leave, like, you know, into the place, and she kind of clues Goldblum into her plan, which is more art forgery.
That's right, baby.
Yeah, it didn't work the first time, so we're doing it again a second time, basically. So Goldblum, you know, tells her off. But basically the plan is that Elliot Shane has like this priceless painting in his mansion, and they know that Goldblum can retrace the painting and like do a perfect forgery of it so that they can swap out the painting and steal it. And the painting is like, you know, behind another painting in the mansion. It's like you have to press a button and it like goes down and stuff like that. It's like stealing the Declaration of Independence in National Treasure.
It's exactly like that.
Linking back to the Cage podcast, this movie is exactly like Xandali and also National Treasure.
So not as fun as one of them and more tame than the other.
Well, when you describe it like that, it sounds like a pretty boring movie.
I mean, they get 2.5 stars.
Yeah, I guess I gave it 3. I was just a little I think I liked it a little bit more than you did. But Goldblum tells her off. He says he doesn't want any part of this plan. And so he goes home, but he's followed home by two of Elliot's henchmen who, you know, think that he poses like a threat to the marriage of Anna and Elliot or whatever. And one of the henchmen is the giant from Twin Peaks, who also knows karate. This is where the karate comes in. And so they get into a slow-mo fight. it was like, you know, just the camera slows down and it's like, blue. And like they pull out these brass knuckles that have the word don't on them. And they're gonna punch Goldblum. But then someone starts shooting and the two guys run off. And it's the guy from earlier who told Kate that he was following her. And he claims to be an FBI agent named Joke, who wants Goldblum's help to catch Kate in the act of art forgery. Already we're at like, you know, several different like, you know, twists and turns and things going on in the movie. So what do you think of this sequence, Mike? The fight scene and then the reveal of Joke.
This actually had one of my biggest laughs right before that. So like, you know, Goldblum is trying to get into his like factory apartment or whatever the hell, because it's 1990 and struggling artist bartenders can afford to just own an entire building or rent an entire building. And he's trying to get in, and then the two henchmen show up. But then his landlord shows up and he's like, oh, thank God. And he thinks he's going to like save him. And he runs over to him. He's like, oh, you know, let me get in the car. And he's like, well, actually, I'm just here to serve you an eviction. You didn't pay your rent. And he hands him the notice out the window and drives away. And that actually got a really big laugh out of me. So that was fun. But then, yeah, I mean, and then a joke shows up and, you know, it kind of reminded me of, you know, Agent Johnson and Special Agent Johnson from Die Hard, that it's just like this kind of gung-ho, like hotshot FBI agent, you know, here to take charge. And this is what's going to happen. And this is my plan. And you're going to follow along because you have no say. Kind of thing. And it's a fun dynamic to play against Goldblum, who at this point is just like confused, like has no idea really what's going on. And this guy is just in there shooting up the alleyway and stuff. So like all this whole section was a good goof.
Yeah. So basically Goldblum agrees to do this plan with Joke and actually do the art forgery with Kate, but with the intention to turn her into Joke once it's all done. And so we kind of cut to, you know, Kate in the building, in the mansion, taking photos of the pictures that Goldblum can actually forge it himself. And Elliot's taking like diction lessons while this is going on. Michael Lerner is like pacing back and forth in his house being like, idea, which is kind of funny. It's, you know, it's one of those things that it's another recurring joke in the movie, and it's fine. It's whatever. And then there's a forgery montage. We get one of those.
Hell yeah, you know, baby.
Those classic forgery montages you see in movies all the time. You get a montage of Goldblum kind of painting and, you know, looking at the picture and, you know, people coming back and forth to the warehouse and all this kind of stuff with the forgery montage. So that's fun. And then Goldblum realizes that Kate's been meeting with this mysterious guy that Goldblum thinks is Saki Budek, who is the guy that she says was the guy who was chasing
the
after
assassin
her,
I think. Sent after yeah, her, yes.
The assassin that was sent after her. So he's like, why would she be meeting with Saki Budek unless she's working with Saki Budek? And then Goldblum discovers that Agent Joke has no toes. So Agent Joke's like looking at Goldblum's painting, and Goldblum is like kind of standing over his shoulder and accidentally steps on his foot, realizes Agent Joke has no toes. And earlier, when Kate described Saki Budek, she said he was a guy with no toes on his right foot. And so now Goldblum's like, wait, he might be Saki Budek. So he goes to warn Kate, but he sees her with the other Saki Budek. And he's explaining the situation to Pete. And this is one of my other favorite lines in the movie where he says, they're all telling the truth and they're all named Saki Budek.
You know what? I just thought of it. I'm gonna add this to the silly names. This the silly names trilogy, which is now Buckaroo Banzai with Big Boute Vibes with Pickel, and now Framed with Saki Budek. Because half the time the joke is just that they say the name Saki Budek.
That's true. So everything is kind of going crazy here. Goldblum doesn't know who to trust with Saki Budek and with Kate and everything like that. But he and Pete kind of move forward with their plan. The heist starts happening. They're driving a truck that says "Really Real Cakes," which is a great cover. You know, just one of those things where, you know, once you see a truck that says "Really Real Cakes," you know they're a real cake company. And so they're theoretically bringing in the wedding cake to Kate and Elliot's wedding. And there's also two kids in the back seat. And you don't know why those kids are in the back seat, but they're just like, "Okay, kids, you ready for this?" And I don't know how the kids showed up. I don't know whose kids they were. I just know that at some point they got kids and put them in the backseat of this car.
Yeah, they kind of don't explain it at all. But I guess that kind of is the MO of this movie, where like it's just happening and you're along for the ride and it doesn't really matter, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm assuming they're like Pete's niece and nephew or something, like something along those lines.
Yeah,
there's got to be some actual logical explanation for why those kids are there. But so, you know, part of their plan, the wedding's going on and, you know, Goldblum gets spotted by the henchmen. So they're kind of chasing after him. They distract the henchmen with this barking bomb. That's you know, it's like a bomb that has like a dog barking attack, like kind of sound that's coming out of it, which you see Pete kind of fiddling with earlier in the movie. And it's leaking while that's going on. So they're all like figuring out what this bomb is while Pete is going to swap the painting. So he has Goldblum's forgery and he's taken the one down from Elliot's collection. And so Goldblum is like, you know, climbing up the roof. The henchmen are chasing after him and he falls off the roof as he escapes the henchmen, disrupting the wedding. It happens like, you know, right behind the window of where the wedding is happening. And so, you know, everybody like goes outside to see what's going on. And Kate pretends that Goldblum is her real husband. And those kids in the back seat are her two kids. They kind of shout, "Mommy." And so she's like, "Oh, I can't marry you, Elliot. I didn't want to leave my old life after all." And he's like, "Okay." kind of. I mean, there's a whole like, "Please forgive me, Elliot." And he's like, "I forgive you." Like, you know, it's this very noble thing on his part. But yeah, so the wedding gets disrupted. They get back and Joke is waiting for them. Still, Goldblum doesn't really know who to trust. But she like Kate's like, "You brought him here. He's the one who's trying to kill me," and that kind of thing and all that stuff. So they tie up both Kate and Joke. They're both attached to like both tied up in chairs. Then there's the callback to Pete's brain thing where, you know, throughout the movie, he's like, "What do you feel like doing?" And the brain's like, "I don't know, because I'm a man." And that kind of thing. So, you know, when they're tied up to chairs and Goldblum's like, "I don't know what to do." And Pete's like, "What do you feel like doing?" And he's like looking looking at Kate and Joke and trying to figure out which one he should free. And then he uncuffs Joke, who immediately reveals himself as Saki Budek.
Yes. No pretense.
Yeah. So what did you think of this reel, Mike, as this movie was kind of, and this is towards the end of the movie now.
Yeah. I mean, that was at that point. Yeah. Why not? I think the whole like art heist wedding scene sequence is very fun and like has this kind of madcap thing. You know, it's a lot of scenes of Goldblum running in a hallway and skidding to turn the corner and then running down that hallway. And like that's fun. Like who doesn't like that kind of stuff, right? And then there's one really big laugh for me at the end of that when they're starting to walk away and Kate has her arms around the kids and the son, I think, is like, "Have a nice day, Elliot," or so he has like some like pithy remark that he says as they turn and walk away, which is pretty funny. Yeah, and then the moment in the warehouse with the Saki Budek reveal. Yeah, well, who cares by now? Yep, we're in the twisty turny Kaiser Soze reveals of who whatever's going on part of this movie, and that's by that point it's a fun goof.
Yeah, because that's like the first of many reveals that kind of come through over the next couple of minutes. But so Joke is Saki Budek all along, and so he pulls a gun on Goldblum. He shoots the phone, he shoots the clock, and stuff like that. And so Goldblum decides, okay, swap the painting for the gun. We'll give you the painting. Just give me the gun. And they do that, and Joke leaves with the painting. And then Kate's like, "I can't believe you set me up like this, and you gave the painting to Saki Budek and all this stuff." And then Goldblum's like, "Well, no, I didn't do that actually, because Pete had the real painting all along, and Goldblum painted two copies."
That's right.
of the painting. It's a crisscross. And that was pretty great. That was probably my favorite reveal of the movie, actually. Just classic heist trickery and twists and stuff like that. Which, and compare this to something like Ocean's 11, which is a very intricately plotted movie with a lot of different moving parts to the heist. As far as this heist goes, for most of its movie, it's just, okay, put a bomb over here that has like a barking dog sound, distract them, and then Pete can go swap the paintings. And that's basically, that's it. That's the heist.
Yeah, that's the whole thing.
So to add this like twist on to the end of it was actually a pretty cool one. Also resulted in one of my other favorite lines in the movie, which is when Pete reveals the real painting and Kate's like, "Is that real?" And he's like, "No, it's a painting."
I forgot about that. That is very good.
It's really solid. So there you go. And then the other Saki Budek, the one that Kate was meeting, wasn't Saki Budek after all, obviously, at this point. He was the guy who she was planning to sell the painting to. He was the buyer that was going to buy the painting from them. He comes in. And then it turns out Elliot's painting was also fake.
Yeah.
They did all this for another fake painting. There was no real painting. They were all forgeries, and they didn't realize it, which was pretty funny. And the buyer like figures that out right away and he leaves. And then it's like, well, what do we do now? Kind of like that's the attitude. And so it kind of cuts to a little bit later, and Goldblum and Kate have now opened up a reproduction store in Paris. They're back in Paris and they're like forging stuff for a living now, basically.
Yeah,
which is a nice little bow to end the movie on. I felt like that was like a pretty clever twist to end it on. And then they show the same umbrella guy at the end of the movie who was in the beginning of the movie, who's like kind of with the rain and stuff like that. And it all came full circle.
Yeah, yeah. It ends in a neat little, you know, just shy of the vibes ending where they literally mug into the camera. it's a little more graceful than that, but well, it's fine, you know.
Yeah, so there you go. I mean, that's Framed. HBO's Framed from 1990. That's where the credits start to roll. So overall, Mike, final thoughts on the movie. What did you think?
I mean, you know, I said 2.5 out of 5 on Letterboxd, and that's kind of how I am. Like, it's inoffensive, I guess. You know, it's one of the, like, it's not bad like the way like Sleepy Hollow is or something like that, where I just hated watching every second of it. Which is strong reaction to a movie that doesn't exist. But for Framed, like, it's fine. Like, it's overall, it's okay. It's kind of wacky and silly. It's 82 minutes, so whatever, I guess. I did really want to highlight, though, the score to this movie I forgot to mention earlier, which connects back, I feel like, not really, but connects in my brain to another Cage Complete Works episode for Rumblefish. It felt a lot like the Stuart Copeland score to Rumblefish, where it's like really percussion heavy and focused like that. And I feel like if you played them side by side, maybe, at least in my memory, they would sound pretty similar, which is pretty cool. So that they're like, you know, the forgery montage was like actually kind of cool, because like it's just the score and stuff like that. So I was into that scene.
Definitely.
So like overall, it's fine. Framed, whatever. We'll never think about it it again.
I liked it a little bit more than you did. I actually think it's my second favorite of the TV movies that we've covered on this podcast, behind Rehearsal for Murder, which is the obvious best. I think it's a solid, fun little heist time. It's not great by any means, but it's charming. It's got Goldblum, Kristen Scott Thomas. Again, it's 82 minutes, so it feels very slight. It feels like I probably will forget a lot of the stuff that happened in the movie like within a couple of weeks. But I had fun while I was watching it. If I saw it again, I'd probably enjoy it again. It's a solid enough time. And that is Framed, which is an HBO TV movie available on YouTube right now. So worth checking out, I think, if you are interested in that kind of thing. If we didn't just spoil the entire movie for you by laying out the plot scene for scene. If you made it to the end of this podcast and still want to watch Framed, it's up on YouTube. As far as Letterboxd reviews go, this is a movie that I think very few people have actually seen or haven't really watched since 1990. So there's not that many reviews on Letterboxd. It's actually only four. I'm going to read you three of them. Cause one of them was just like, hey, it's an HBO movie. I liked it. So the other three, first off, we have one from our friend, the Poetic Critic, again, reviewing Framed here, a 3-star review. And, this is 4 lines. Maybe it's a stanza, I guess. I don't know exactly.
You got to brush up. You got to do some poetry training, and then come back.
I got to tag my 7th grade English teacher in a post on Twitter. Just be like, hey, can you give me some pointers here on how this works? But the Poetic Critic, it's a 4-line poem. I believe it's called a stanza, and it reads, when Goldblum is the male lead and the aim is finding people quirkier than he to serve as backup, it risks being lame. But there is pleasure here, if quite low key.
Yeah, that's nice.
I think it's a pretty good way to describe the movie, actually. That's about where I am with the movie. It's a pleasurable, fine time. But all right, here's another review from Ultimate Movie Rankings. They gave it a 2, and it reads, why did I watch this one? I like the two leads, Kristen Scott Thomas and Jeff Goldblum. What is this one about? A painter is accused of art forging. He thinks his girlfriend betrayed him, so it's time for revenge. He literally just quoted the IMDb plot synopsis.
That's the
that. My thoughts on this one: a weak con movie starts off slow and gets slower, and then ends with a pretty weak ending. And not much to recommend here. Goldblum's character seems pretty clueless throughout the movie, and in the end, he still seems pretty clueless. That is not what I want my movie heroes to be. Final thought: skip this movie. No wonder I had never heard of this movie before. And finally, this is a really great review, a 4-star review from Eric Wong. Thank you, Dollar Tree, for having this on DVD for $1. Great little con man comedy with hilarious Goldblum. Really fun movie. Totally worth owning for $1. And that, I think, is the way to describe Framed. Because if I saw it on DVD at Dollar Tree, I would probably also get it for $1. I think if I had $1 to spare, I would spend it on buying Framed on DVD.
Absolutely. That tracks. This movie is absolutely worth $1.
Exactly. All right. And I believe that can wrap things up for us today, Mike. So where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MD Film Blog on Twitter and Letterboxd.
And you can find me online at M Smith Film Blog on Twitter, Mike Smith Film on Letterboxd, and Radio Mike Sandwich on Instagram. Thank you for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That's my Decree Show. Don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app. And if you want to contact us, hit us up at JeffGoldblumCompleteWorks@gmail.com. And you can find the rest of our podcast on Rapture Press alongside the totally original Geek News Podcast, which is a podcast about comic books and movie news and all that nerdy stuff. And you can follow this podcast on Twitter at Goldblum Pod. Our theme song was created by Kyle Cullen, who you can reach for your own podcast themes at kylespodcastthemes@gmail.com. And our logo was designed by Jacob Honeycutt or at Jacob Honey on Twitter. So you can join us next week on The Complete Works. Jeff Goldblum stars in an erotic thriller, not Zondali, that hopefully we can actually find. It's called Twisted Obsession, a.k.a. El Sueño del Mano Loco, which I forget the exact translation of the Spanish title, but it's not Twisted Obsession. It's something much weirder.
Something of the crazy monkey. I forget. The luck of the crazy monkey.
Something along those lines. We will get all into that next week, hopefully, if we can find the movie. Otherwise, we'll be reviewing whatever is next. But keep listening for our bonus episodes of Mike and Mike Go to the Movies 2. And thanks so much for listening, guys. Remember to go for the Goldblum.